employment benefits is on the agenda this morning. Manuel's going to take us through at least the initial papers.
Are you doing the whole lot?
I'll probably do the whole lot.
Wow.
Probably.
Then he'll probably do the whole lot. What's happening with you? Okay, Manuel, over to you.
Thanks, Warren. Agenda paper 4 just provides an overview of what we'll be discussing today. It also presents the updated project timetable. The papers we'll be discussing today include Agenda Paper 4A, the comment letter summary, and we'll also begin re-deliberations on the proposals in the exposure draft, specifically the proposals on recognition, disaggregation, and the definition of the finance cost. Now, in the last month's meeting, we did say that we intended to bring a paper on scope as well. However, we don't think that a paper on scope is necessary at this point, so I think we'll just proceed based on the scope of the project in the exposure draft for the time being. We'll continue to bring up any additional issues that come up through the comment letters, and we'll bring these to the board when appropriate. We will at some point bring a list of additional issues that have come up in the comment letters to the board for completeness, just to discuss those with you. Appendix A presents the updated timetable. So next month there's going to be a whole range of papers. Some of them depend on the decisions made at this month, specifically on presentation and also perhaps decisions on settlements and curtailments. So it's quite important that we do get decisions today on the disaggregation and on the finance cost. We'll also plan to bring in papers on disclosures and some of the other issues that were addressed in the ED in November. I should note that there is an editorial error in paragraph 4. It should say the board in order to finalise an amendment by March 2011, not 2010. Yeah. Is there any comments on the updated project plan? Or? Okay. So we'll continue on to agenda paper 4A.
Yep. Yep.
As mentioned before, agenda paper 4A, this is a comment letter summary. The comments period ended on the 6th of September 2010. At the time of writing, we had received, I think, 225 comment letters. I think we've received 226 so far. There was one that came in just after we posted. We have an analysis of the comment letters by constituent type and geographic region in Appendix A. As you can see, we did get quite a lot of comment letters from preparers and specifically from Europe and North America. We didn't receive that many comment letters from users. However, we did receive one after posting this, after posting the comment letter summary from a user group. We will be taking those comments into account in the papers going forward, but I don't think that the views expressed in that comment letter were very different to the views expressed otherwise. We had the Employee Benefits Working Group meeting on the 27th of September. At that meeting, we discussed, among other things, presentation and disclosure. The presentation session really focused on the finance cost, and I'll talk a bit about the feedback provided by the Employee Benefits Working Group when we get to that paper. Overall, I think the comments in the comment letters were fairly consistent with the comments and the feedback that we received during our outreach that we presented at the last meeting. I don't intend to go into this in detail, especially on the papers that we'll be discussing today. We'll get into that detail a bit more later. But in general, overall, I guess, consistent with what we've heard previously, that people are fairly supportive of the overall objectives, improving transparency, comparability, and understandability by eliminating the options. There are still some concerns there, as we expressed last month, that this is a short-term project and it's a limited scope project. There are those that still believe that we should be moving forward with a comprehensive review instead of performing a limited scope interim project. I'll just skip over the recognition disaggregation comments. I'll move on to presentation, which is from paragraph 21.
I have two comments or questions. One on paragraph 6 about the social impact of our proposals. When some say that our proposals might affect investment allocation within plans and discourage investment in equities, are there any people who say the contrary, saying that by putting all the volatility in the measurement of the plan assets in OCI and having less volatility in P&L, that would actually encourage investing in equities rather than discourage? I was a bit surprised by the argument made, and I think you can make exactly the opposite point, and I wanted to know whether anyone has made this argument.
Yeah, I think people do talk about the behavioural implications from both sides.
Right.
So I think that's fair to say. I don't think it's completely one sided, and we talk a bit about that in the finance cost paper about the behavioural implications.
Okay.
But yes, there are arguments on both sides.
Okay. My second point is about something I did not get clearly what the message in 17C, which is about disaggregation. Some apparently said that our proposal will not allow to analyze an entity separately from the effect of the pension plan. And I just could not understand why, because we are in effect presenting on separate line items, or we propose to present on separate line items all the elements that relates to the effect of the pension plan. So people who want to see the entity without the impact of the pension plan, I would quite easily find it. So where does this comment find, so where, what's behind it?
I guess this comment, and we'll probably talk about it a bit more when we get to the disaggregation paper, but some analysts out there have mentioned to us that they prefer to look at companies on a pre- and a post-pension basis. And it's much easier for them to sort of take out the pensions component if it's all in one number. So they prefer no disaggregation.
I think
what they would like to see is pension expense treated as a period cost rather than as a compensation cost, because if you treat it as a compensation cost, it would go through work in process into finished goods, into cost of sales, so some of the pension costs would be in the balance sheet and some would be in the income statement, so they wouldn't get what they don't get what they think they get today, because unless inventory turns very fast, you've got some of it hung up in the balance sheet.
Hang on, Philippe, what you say?
I think maybe you can take it offline, but I understand less on less.
Well,
because
okay.
Today, pension costs are part of inventories and eventually self-generated assets, etc. It goes into the cost of doing business. Tomorrow, we will have a more recurring element in the P&L that will also go into inventories or whatever. And what you don't have now in our proposal is a volatility, which I think is a problem in the effect of the volatility in the pension plan assets. It's probably a problem in the determination of the cost of inventories or cost of production. So to me, our proposals would make it even easier to do the restatement or to understand.
I'm agreeing with you. I'm trying to explain what I think is a misconception on the part of some that the way it's presented today, you can just take the total cost that's disclosed in the footnote and just take that out of net income, when in fact that isn't entirely true.
Tetsumi? You on there?
Okay, thank you. On this particular point, when I had the outreach meeting in Hong Kong, several companies, they see the cost as the one line, and it's a sort of the operating cost. And if it is divided into, say, financing, it's against what they have in mind. So, and in order to reflect sort of their views of the reality, so one line presentation is much better, and they don't care about to provide some information as a note, say three factors, but they strongly believe that this is a operation or part of the operation cost, and it should be presented in this way.
Okay, look, we're going to come back to this issue when we look at that particular paper. So can we leave that at this stage? And
yeah.
Manny, if you could continue.
Thanks, Warren. Just on presentation, we'll be discussing presentation at the next board meeting. I just wanted to touch briefly on some of the comments that we've received. A lot of the times when people talked about the presentation proposals in the exposure draft, they talked about the interaction with other projects and the fundamental issues regarding performance reporting, what goes into OCI and recycling. Having said that, there was a lot of support for presenting the remeasurement components in OCI. I think very few people said we don't want the remeasurement component presented in OCI. And I think the same with the service costs and finance costs. There was a lot of support for presenting the service costs in profit and loss. However, there were some concerns about whether we should be presenting separately the finance cost and the service cost. Some people see the one arising as a consequence of the other, and they prefer to see it all as Tatsumi said, a personnel or a labour cost. There was a lot of support, as I mentioned earlier, for eliminating the options for presentation. However, a few did note that there may be some basis for retaining an option or a requirement to present the remeasurement in profit and loss under certain circumstances, such as if it's an unfunded plan and the entity holds assets whose change in value goes through the P&L as well. On settlements and curtailments, the ED proposed that gains and losses on settlements go through OCI and gains and losses on curtailments go through the profit and loss. Many disagreed with the ED proposal to present the gain and loss on non-routine settlements differently from curtailments. I think that's an issue with the current definitions. There's quite a bit of overlap at the moment between settlements and curtailments, and they thought it would be very difficult to determine the amount that relates to the settlements and the curtailment components, especially since these transactions usually happen at the same time. So they thought that we need to look into this a lot more. A lot of them suggested that we should be proposing the same accounting for settlements and curtailments and plan amendments. So we should be presenting those effects in the same place. On disclosures, as discussed in the last meeting, there was a lot of support for the disclosure objectives in the exposure draft. However, while many people supported those objectives, they didn't necessarily support the approach in the exposure draft of having the disclosure objectives and then a list of disclosures following that. A lot of respondents noted that this approach is not very flexible. It's a one-size-fits-all type of approach. And there were concerns about the application of materiality when it comes to disclosures and the application of judgment in assessing the level of required disclosure. There were, on the specific additional disclosures proposed in the exposure draft, there was quite a bit of support for including disclosures, enhanced disclosures about the risks arising from defined benefit plans. However, there was varying levels of support for the sensitivity analysis requirements. Some would prefer that the sensitivity was limited to perhaps specific assumptions, the discount rate, for instance. Others weren't sure whether the sensitivity was to provide users information about the risk or the measurement uncertainty inherent in the measurement. Regarding actuarial assumptions, there was support for the board replacing the current list of actuarial assumptions that require disclosure with a principle which allows them to use their judgments. However, they were not as supportive of the disclosure requirements about the process used to determine those demographic assumptions. Many people thought that this disclosure would be boilerplates, it would not be particularly useful, and it would be the same each year and across entities. I mean, a common comment was that people get their actuaries to determine their actuarial assumptions. So.
In paragraph little D 2, I think there is an important point. I agreed with the comment when I read the comment that without understanding the demographics of the population to which the defined benefit plan applies, it is quite hard to understand this figure of the defined benefit obligation. So, don't we require in general that some information be provided about the population in doing the demographic assumptions? You have to look, of course, at the population and at demographic or mortality assumptions in general, but of course in the context of the population. So did we miss something in our disclosures, or did we deliberately exclude information about the demographics of the population of the entity?
No, I think, the disclosure about the process used to determine the demographic assumptions, I think, came about when we were discussing disclosures for demographic assumptions, whether disclosures for the mortality of the membership would be useful to users. And I think the board at the time thought that it would be very difficult for a user to, for example, use disclosures of life expectancies, etc., without knowing what to make a judgment about the amounts, and that's why I think the board decided to propose that at least disclosing how often the mortality tables are updated, perhaps disclosure along those lines might be more useful. However, the comments in the comment letter suggested that this isn't going to be that as useful as perhaps, you know, disclosing the assumptions themselves, and in some cases perhaps not as useful as disclosing the sensitivity around those assumptions for mortality as well.
Maybe I could add something there as well, because I was probably one of the main pushers for this disclosure, because I had concerns about actually disclosing the assumptions themselves and about the usefulness of disclosing the assumptions themselves. I think it's pretty clear from the comment letters that people didn't understand why we proposed this. I'm part of that, maybe the wording, that may not be just the wording, but the wording I think we lifted from a very similar requirement in IFRS 4, where we have it for the same reason, that it's just not really feasible to disclose all the individual assumptions that go in there, and we were looking for something that would convey some useful information instead. But I thought, Philippe, you were making a slightly different point, which was maybe we should actually be requiring some basic demographic disclosure about the plan as well.
My point is that a user should know that if you are operating a mine in certain countries in Latin America, or if you are employing bankers, staff, white-collar staff, the mortality might not be the same in general. But that might not be enough. And people may want more precise information about the experience in mortality or whatever of the population, maybe on a segment basis, I don't know, or on a geographical area, because that will impact massively the calculation of the defined benefit obligation. So boilerplate, maybe to say I'm a bank, so my mortality experience is very good, but that is not enough to understand really, because even in different countries, you may have different life expectancy in different areas of the world, even in the same banking business, maybe.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the concerns, that if the disclosure was going to be meaningful, in a lot of cases it would need to be extremely granular, probably, and in a way that's maybe not feasible to do.
On the disclosure of the defined benefit obligation, excluding the effect of salary increases, there wasn't that much support for this disclosure. A lot of commentators weren't sure what the objective of the disclosure was. It would only be useful in certain circumstances, and therefore it would be inappropriate to require a disclosure only because it would be relevant to some users in limited circumstances. On the asset liability matching strategy,
I thought the alternative suggestion by some respondents was pretty good. That is the one that follows E in your list. And I looked in the standard to see if we now have that, and I guess we don't, to take the defined benefit obligation and split it between vested, accrued, unvested, the amount that reflects future salary increases. I think that made a lot of sense to me, and I'm surprised we don't have it now.
Yeah, that comment came from I think a couple of people that noted that the expected salary increases may not be the most informative basis of making that alternative measure. They thought, okay, we have the defined benefit obligation. In some countries, the vesting portion is more important. In other countries, So I think that was quite a useful suggestion. We'll explore that further when we talk about disclosures.
I had the same reaction as you. I thought it was a very good suggestion. Go ahead.
When I read the suggestion, I had in mind the disclosure we proposed for leases, for the lease liability, where we say the minimum lease liability and the expected contingent rent being separated in the notes. And to me, to a certain extent, that is a very similar kind of breakdown.
Okay. On the asset liability matching strategies, views were a bit mixed. Some supported the disclosure. Others thought it would just result in boilerplates. Some suggested that it should be integrated a lot better with other disclosures, such as the disclosures about the plan assets and the disclosures about the risks that the plan exposes the entity to. On the disclosure about contributions differing from service costs in the future. There was a lot of confusion about this disclosure. They didn't know what the purpose was. Respondents noted that there were many arbitrary factors that would affect contributions that would not affect service costs, including the regulatory framework, but also, you know, the cash position of the company and whether it can make contributions. There were some useful suggestions, I think, about improving that disclosure. A lot of people noted that the disclosure of perhaps the duration of the liability combined with the maturity of the defined benefit obligation will provide more useful information. But also the effect of any funding requirements, such as minimum funding requirements, etc. They thought that would be quite useful to have. Just to move on to the other issues in the exposure draft now. Again, I'm going to, we went through these last month, so I'm going to go through these briefly and touch on a few of these. Taxes and administration costs. I think there was quite a lot of pushback on administration costs proposals. As I mentioned last month, people not only didn't support these on conceptual grounds, even if they thought that the conceptual basis was sound, they still thought there'd be practical difficulties in differentiating the identifying the costs that need to be included, but also splitting those costs between past and future service. There was quite a lot of support for attribution and the proposals for mortality assumptions and risk sharing. However, there are some concerns about the effects of those proposals for attribution, the effect on the contribution-based promises, those class of promises that we tried to address in the discussion paper. And for risk sharing, they were concerned about the implementation of the proposals in the exposure draft. Regarding the classification of benefits as short term and long term, there's still a bit of work we need to do there. There's some useful suggestions that have come through the comment letters, so we'll work with that. As I mentioned last month, there was a lot of pushback on merging the classifications of post employment and other long term employment benefits categories. BD proposed to remove this difference. It was thought that with the removal of the corridor, there wouldn't be that much different between the two categories. However, the proposals would require that the presentation and disclosure proposals in the ED would apply to other long-term employee benefits. Many respondents thought that it was inappropriate. It was a bit of scope creep. They thought the accounting for other long-term benefits hasn't been seen as very problematic, so they weren't sure why we were making that change. There have been other issues that were raised in that were not discussed in the exposure draft. As I mentioned earlier, we'll try and bring a complete list of these issues to you at a future meeting, but some of the ones that we've picked up at the moment include interim reporting. This is both on recognition and on the calculation of the finance cost and the changes at interim periods. Also, the timing of recognition for plan amendments, settlements, and curtailments. There was a request for more guidance on when those plan changes should be accounted for. And of course, people also brought up the discount rate, which we've tried to address previously.
Go ahead, Philip.
On this one, I'm a bit confused. The ones who are now commenting and asking that we reopen the debate, are they the same ones who have suggested the previous amendment, or are they different types of people? Because it's a recurring matter, and we open it, we look at it, and finally we close it and say we can't do it, and it comes again. So are they the same?
I think it's the same. It would be the same types of constituents that would ask, and from the same regions that would ask for us to address this.
Greg, what?
On the cost, can I ask questions related to the last paragraph on page 15?
What paragraph are you, sir?
The paragraph 47.
47. 47. Wow. Go ahead.
you mentioned the operational difficulties, but this paragraph gave me some kind of hint. You know, the professionals don't like the number to be published or to be shown some way. Just like auditors charge a lot of fees, but they don't like people know. I'm not sure what's the views from the preparers. You know, you particularly mentioned the worry come from the professionals.
I think it's a slightly different thing. I don't think that it's about disclosure of the admin costs. I think it's more where do you draw the line of which admin costs are in and which ones are not. So, for instance, if you've got you outsource all your handling of payments and stuff, you would fairly naturally want to capitalise, put that into the DBO. But if you did that in-house, then it's more difficult to see when that part of the job finishes and when the next job, and then you extend it to a lot of the operations. So I think it's more about how do you actually draw the line than about disclosure or information that isn't wanted to be out in the public domain.
Sure. My understanding is that, I mean, at the moment there's a choice, and some companies do put the admin costs in the measurement of the DBO liability. So is that true? And if so, presumably that problem has been solved by them.
Well, it's more that it's not so much a choice, I think. It's a little bit unclear in the wording of the standard. I mean, we see that the principle is the ultimate cost of the benefits should be in the DBO. How people have interpreted that varies, and possibly by jurisdiction as well. I think there's historical baggage on that one. When we considered this for the ED, we tried to put a fence around it because we said that's an existing problem with IAS 19 and it goes into the heart of the measurement of the DBO. We're not looking at the measurement of the DBO, so we should leave this issue well alone for now. But we tried to put a little bit of clarity just to get rid of some of the diversity in practice based on what we've heard. It looks from the comments that the diversity is more entrenched, I suppose, and that we would be causing a significant amount of grief if we try to fix it here. So that's what people are telling us, really.
Thank you. Okay. On the transition proposed in the exposure draft, a lot of the respondents supported our retrospective applications. However, there were some concerns about applying some of the disclosures retrospectively, so that they thought that we should have a look at the disclosures and see whether any of those should be applied on a prospective basis. Any further comments?
If there's not. Philip, you have a comment?
I have a question about in paragraph 54, the risk sharing. Risk sharing, and I know we have one jurisdiction which has still a number of questions about how our proposals will apply in that jurisdiction, and it's a European jurisdiction. Do you have any specific plans to continue discussing with those constituents how to find a solution?
Because we
are invited to an OECD meeting in Paris in early December, and I'm pretty sure, as it happened in the past, that representatives from the government of that country will make a lot of comments about our proposals, and I would like to be satisfied and comfortable that before that we have had a chance to sit down with them and to try to resolve the issue.
Yes, we're still working with them to improve the proposals, and we'll be bringing the issue back in, I think, either November or December, most likely December, to discuss.
Yeah, we timetabled it in December, if you look at Appendix A of the cover note, and part of the reason for that was to allow us more time to explore. We put it in December to allow us more time to explore the issue.
Go on, side points, Steve.
And just on that issue, are we going to be able to get to a point where we actually have some numbers to back up this?
That's, we're working with them at the moment to get some examples to illustrate how the proposals would work in practice. I think we've asked a number of people to help us on that from those jurisdictions, and we're waiting on them to come back to us on that.
My sense is that we were rather struggling to get some people to actually provide us with examples, how they would want to do it, exactly what the calculations are, and I just wondered if you've been successful in.
Yeah, there was an example in one of the comment letters.
However, that example is quite complex, so we're looking for simplified examples to illustrate the principles of the proposals in the ED separately, so it can be a bit more clear what the issues are in practice. So we've asked them to come back to us, but we'll see what comes from that.
Another point is that these risk-sharing arrangements are not unique to that country or that jurisdiction, and we've identified a couple of other companies in other jurisdictions who do risk-sharing, and we're trying to work with them as well to try and find out the commonalities and understand how they deal with it.
So just how widespread is this? A couple of other companies, or...?
Oh, no, I think in terms of jurisdictions, there's one jurisdiction in particular where it's quite prevalent. There are a couple of other jurisdictions in Europe that it is quite widespread. However, due to the circumstances in the current economy, there are a lot of individual companies out there that have been making adjustments to their plan designs, introducing these features. So there are people out there that are...
So it's an emerging issue as well.
Part of it is that, as far as I understand, the risk-sharing features are prevalent. What's not prevalent is the concerns with the way IS19 applies to them. And what we're trying to understand is why those concerns are particularly vocal in that particular... whether it's a particular feature of the plans or a particular way of reading it, or that's what we're not 100% clear of yet.
Okay, so you're trying to track that down.
Yeah.
Come back to us. That's Tatsumi?
Thank you.
I missed my opportunity, so can I come back?
How far back are you going?
Sorry?
How far back are you going?
Oh, paragraph 24. Yeah, because I didn't understand the rules of this discussion.
It's a lame excuse.
So,
how long have you been here?
It's related to recycling. No. But So, latter part of the paragraph 24, so it's related to the capitalization of the sum of the costs. So I think this includes, I have heard a lot from the manufacturers say, if we apply this presentation, OCI, some factors which are recognized as OCI, but they think something related to the, say, workers' cost in farms or factories. So they think that one is part of the manufacturing cost, and it should be recycled and to consist part of the, say, cost of sales. So that part is, I think, currently, once it is recognized or presented as OCI, we prohibited the recycling, but that troubled them a lot. So it's a part of their cost. As long as, say, once it happens in a factory, they think it's all the cost related to the cost of sales. But once it is recognized as part of OCI, we prohibited the recycling. So that does not fit what they have in mind. So I think that will you have an opportunity to give your thoughts on this issue in the future?
Yeah, when we talk about presentation, we'll discuss this issue as well.
Okay.
I think we understood the issue very well.
Yeah, but I'm not sure it's part of the presentation issue or calculation of the cost of sales. I'm not sure, but in any case, as long as you will give a thought, I'm okay. I would like to make sure you will think about it.
Yeah, we'll think about it.
I think in the context of this project, it has to be in the presentation. Yeah. We don't have another home for it, really.
Thank you. Likewise.
Yeah, similar issue. Overall, pensions, as I understand, not very big issues in that part of the world, around Japan, China, Taiwan or Korea, because a lot of schemes governments mandated. And but the issues Tatsumi raised is quite critical, is because all these countries are manufacturing oriented, and for them they look at this issue seems quite ridiculous. And for financial institutions and other entities provide service, they will accept, because most of the time the costs related to that areas are period costs, no problem. But for manufacturing companies, seems such kind of separations, it is not meaningful for them. But I don't heard any words related to recycling, because as I understand, recycling means from this period to another. And this issue, basically, they said from the beginning you should put them together and not actually related to recycle issues.
Okay, well, we'll come back to this. Paul?
In IAS 19 now, both for short-term benefits, post-employment benefits, and I guess all the others, there's a statement that says these shall be expense unless recognized as an expense unless another standard requires or permits them to be included as the cost of an asset, for example, IAS 2 and IAS 16. Will those two this identical sentence for both short-term and long-term, they're almost inconsistent with this, with the, you know, a non-recycling proposal. I'm not a recycler, believe me, but how can we say, you know, unless another standard says to put it in cost of sales, which we do if you go to IAS 2 or IAS 16 on property on depreciation, when here we are saying, well, you can't recycle.
It's a fair point, Philippe.
I had a similar concern when I read the comment here. And I asked myself, but I did not go back to check with IS2, for something to be included in the cost of sales, in the cost of a product, is it required that it has been first expensed in P&L and then taken out of P&L into the cost, or could something that went to OCI be considered in the costing of the product? I wasn't sure about the answer. It may be that you can take some items from the OCI category and say that it's part of my cost of sales, the cost of my product.
It's recycling, Philippe. It would end up in...
It's indirect recycling, in a way. Recycling from OCI to balance sheet without going back to P&L. But in the mechanics of OCI today, if I look at the cost of my products, I try to determine my cost of sales, can I only look at those things which are normally part of my profit and loss or also part of my OCI? I wasn't sure about the answer to the question.
We'll come back to this.
Bank credit OCI. Debit P&L, debit balance sheet, credit OCI.
Credit, well, that's crediting.
Normally, I debit inventories, credit P&L. Can I debit inventories, credit OCI? It's a question I have. I don't know.
Not under this approach, but it's a point we'll come back to. But this is an implication of putting things in OCI without recycling. You need to understand that. Paul?
There's actually a related disclosure issue as well, because somewhere I can't find it right now, but I know it says you must disclose the amount of pension expense that's in profit or loss. What exactly does that mean? If it's first gone through cost of sales, do you have to pull out the piece that's in cost of sales or not? Otherwise, and if the answer is no, leave it in cost of sales, what is our disclosure? What are we requiring?
But this is a point that came up earlier. I think Pat was referring to that. We'll come back to that issue.
One comment. This is exactly the reason, Paul, why manufacturing company oppose to disclose by nature information proposed in our FSP sent the proposal. They said, how can I do? You know,
by the way, we have a similar problem in IAS 16 which says disclose depreciation expense for the period. Well, what do we mean by that if for a manufacturer the vast amount of depreciation is actually somewhere up in cost of sales?
Thank you, Paul.
Yeah, I didn't realize this project had so many tentacles. Yeah. Okay. Manuel, are you right then to move on?
Yeah, we'll move on to agenda paper 4B, which is on the recognition proposals in the exposure draft. There's two sections to this paper. One is on the removal of the corridor, and the other section is on unvested past service. Just a brief overview of the comments in the received from respondents to the exposure draft. A significant majority of respondents supported the board's proposal set out in the basis. In addition to the reasons given by the board, respondents also stated that they supported the proposal because it was more consistent with the conceptual framework, more consistent with US GAAP. The corridor method is just an arbitrary mechanism, and the proposal would reduce complexity, enhance consistency and understandability of the amounts reported. However, a few respondents, particularly pension funds and other organisations that have a focus really on public policy implications, disagreed with the proposal for some of the reasons stated in paragraph 9. Again, this is back to the fundamental issue of measurements. A lot of people don't think we should be changing recognition until we deal with measurements. Some see the two go in hand in hand. Some are also concerned about the introduction of volatility in an entity's statement of financial position. They accept that through the presentation proposals we've removed some of that volatility from profit and loss. However, a lot of entities out there, I think specifically financial institutions, are quite concerned about the volatility in equity. And some also noted concerns with interim reporting and whether they would have to, if we remove the corridor, whether they would have to remeasure their plan assets and DBO at each interim reporting period.
But you'll come back on that issue, won't you?
We will come back on the interim reporting, yes.
To know about the financial institutions, have we had a specific contact with the banking regulators on this topic, prudential supervisors? Because today, they have information about what is recognized and what is left off balance sheet not recognized because of the mechanisms, corridor, etc., and deferral of the actual gains or losses. Today, what do the banking regulators do with the current IAS 19 with that information when they assess the financial stability of a bank? Do they disregard the off-balance sheet or unrecognized liabilities? Tomorrow they will have on-balance sheet. Will they change their attitude to looking at the bank? I think we need to understand more. They understand. They have all the information. So whether it is off or on-balance sheet, will that change the way they look at the bank?
Does anyone know, Steve?
My understanding is that they actually exclude the amount that's in OCI. So I think they make no adjustment in respect of the corridor and they just leave that as it's reported. And the amount that goes into OCI, the alternative at the moment, they actually exclude it. That's certainly my understanding for the UK.
Oh, okay. Amara, do you have a...
Trying to respond, the general view, the regulators generally exclude what they call non-core capital or non-quality capital. Well, it depends on the jurisdiction, but generally the recommendation from the Basel Committee on the calculation of capital is to use, and especially under Basel III that's coming out, is to focus on what they call core capital. And core capital meaning the capital or the instruments that really they have the capacity to cover losses immediately when they occur. So I would generally expect them to follow the same pattern on all jurisdictions. I don't know if in South Africa it's a little bit different.
But that explains it if it's a credit, but if it's a debit and there's a debit in OCI.
It's generally the same.
They draw that as well.
Generally. I cannot, of course, assess for everyone, but this is the general approach.
Thanks, Tamara.
Okay. Just moving on to the staff analysis. The board did have an extensive arguments in the basis for conclusions in the exposure draft for immediate recognition. We don't believe that the responses provide any additional information that would invalidate those arguments in the basis. And in terms of, interactions with other projects and a future project on pensions that would consider the measurement issue, the board has previously decided that there is a significant benefit in addressing this issue in the short term, and we don't see any reason why that argument should be invalidated either. Is there any other comments before we go to the
Paul?
Before we go to question one.
Yeah.
I wonder, could you confirm to me that when you say in question one, does the board confirm the proposal to recognize changes in fair value when they occur, recognize as income or expense?
Recognize.
Not parking on the balance sheet. That could be recognition. So recognize as income and expense, right?
Recognize in the statement of income.
Well, and bear in mind that we have made clear that whether something ends up in profit, loss, or OCI, an item of income or expense.
So it is, right. I'm not getting into that debate. Just make sure
correct.
We're talking about somewhere it goes on the statement of total comprehensive income.
Yeah. There's also, it's not going to include, obviously, balance sheet movements, the cash movements in and out of the plan.
Okay.
The surplus or the deficits in the plan will be recognised on the balance sheet of the entity. That's what we're saying.
Mm. And in the statement of comprehensive income changes.
Did
it?
We can say and in comprehensive income, not in this statement of comprehensive income at this point.
You can say that, yes. Okay. Are there any other comments people would like to make? I mean, obviously there's the issue of the next phase of the project, which I think we've discussed, and that's an issue for the board in terms of its forward agenda. But we feel that at this stage it's important to make some improvements, particularly from a convergence perspective, but not only from that. And we know there are some ongoing issues concerning presentation of information in the statements of profit and loss and the comprehensive income, to use Philippe's expression, that the board is going to be considering at some point in the future, this question of what goes into OCI and whether things are recycled or not and when that would occur. And we've understood that there are issues that are going to be discussed at some point in the future. But at this stage, I think certainly the exposure draft, and as Manuel said, in terms of our basis for conclusions, we felt that this was a justifiable approach at this point in time. So are there any other comments that people would like to make on this? Yes, that's in.
Just a question. So have you got a lot of comments which support everything should be recognized as part of net income rather than part of the changes in OCI?
In other words, did you get all those letters from Tatsumi's family?
We'll talk about that in the next month, but as I mentioned previously, there was quite a large majority that supported presenting remeasurements in OCI. There were only a very few that thought we shouldn't be presenting remeasurements in OCI.
Do they understand the meaning of the OCI? That means that still I do not understand our proposals, what the meaning of the OCI items, because I understand the total return of actual return of the asset and minus just the sort of the calculated interest. So and the remaining is as recognized as OCI. I do not understand the meaning of that OCI. So the respondents clearly understand the meaning of the OCI.
We'll come back to that.
We're talking about recognition today. We'll talk about presentation in the next month. At the moment, what this proposal will say is that the change will be recognized in the statement of comprehensive income. Next month, we'll talk about the geography and whether we should be presenting it in OCI or whatever.
Okay. Philippe?
Very quickly, I think there has been a very good explanation given now in the revised basis for conclusions of the paper on the on credit risk and liabilities, where we clearly expressed the board's position on the fact that the recycling, the presentation in OCI or P&L is a matter for future reflections of the board. So for consistency, I would like that sentence in paragraph BC530 to be picked up and included in our basis for conclusions on that project, so that we have the same explanations of where we stand in terms of looking at this matter.
Okay. Thanks, Philippe. Steve?
Well, just on this question one, I think I was very surprised actually by the amount of support we got for this. I mean, it was perhaps not quite overwhelming, but it was certainly very, very strong. And I noticed that there are some individual companies that currently use the corridor method that obviously don't wish to change. But there were one or two institutions, one European standard setter, one European preparer organization that opposed this. But I just wondered if there were any new arguments that came from those letters. Is it essentially the volatility argument? This is a long-term issue and we need to sort of reflect that, and smoothing it is the best way of doing it. Was that really the main argument?
Well, I'm not sure if it's the volatility. I think it was more a concern that we were tackling recognition before we tackle measurements fundamentally. If we haven't answered the question that this measurement is the best basis to measure the DBO, they had concerns about recognizing that amounts based on that measurement in the balance sheet, basically. So it was more concerned about timing. They thought that they agreed that, you know, theoretically we should be recognizing everything at the same time. However, they were concerned about the measurement basis used.
Okay. That doesn't make me want to not do this now. I think we should do it. I agree with Warren.
Okay, well, on that note, can I ask the board the question set out on page 8, question 1, and whether the board confirms the exposure draft proposal to recognise all changes as they occur? That was very good of you, PK, to come in and hand up. Hadn't heard all the pride about it. I think that was unanimous of less 12 of us present today.
13.
Oh, me too. Who are we missing? Oh, you're off. Oh, sorry. I was counting. I was counting you out before. Yeah, 3 to 13.
Okay.
Okay, Manuel?
Okay, so we'll move on to the recognition of unvested past service costs. In general, the responses in the comment letters were quite consistent between question one and question two. Those that agreed with the support of the board's proposal for removing the corridor also supported the board's proposal for recognising unvested past service costs. However, there were some that agreed with the first one but disagreed with the second one for the following reasons. They believe that the amending the plan gives rise to a future economic benefit, and they believe that that future economic benefit should be recognised over the vesting period. They also note that the requirements in IS 19 inconsistent with the requirements in IFRS 2 on share-based payments, where the unvested service cost is recognised over the vesting period. There are also concerns about the behavioural implications, again, whether this would discourage entities from improving benefits because they'll have to take the cost up front. There are also some concerns about potential for arbitrage. Depending on how you structure a plan amendment, you can get different results. In addition to those comments, some did request clarification over when a plan amendment has occurred, specifically over, you know, the timing of recognition, and we'll discuss that when we also talk about settlements and curtailments, and we'll deal with them all at once next month. Now, the board has previously acknowledged that the ED proposal is inconsistent with IFRS 2. However, this project does not include re-examining the recognition for defined benefits in IAS 19 at the moment. That is based on the benefit formula. So if the board retains attribution of benefits in accordance with the benefit formula, then unvested past service cost is a liability in accordance with IAS 19. So I think at the end of the day, I think this attributing unvested past service cost is arbitrary. However, I think we should try and keep IAS 19 internally consistent instead of accepting unvested past service costs arising from plan amendments from the general rule. So therefore, the staff recommends that the board confirm the proposal in the exposure draft. Are there any comments before we move on to the question?
This is obviously a difficult question, and I was very worried or puzzled by the argument that people make, which is expressed in 19A, that if you make a plan amendment, that becomes an incentive for people to deliver more quality services. For instance, it will improve the economic benefits in the future to the entity, and that the related expense should be recognized in a way which matches the extra economic benefits that arise to the entity. And if you don't recognize the past period, you don't adjust the past recognition, and you spread the extra benefit over the period during which you receive extra resources to the entity, I think the argument makes a lot of sense to me in terms of economics. And I agree with the fact that once you have taken a decision, you are committing to something more, but whether that commitment should be recognized over past periods, last period or not, if you take the leasing, for instance, when we make an adjustment to the recognition of contingent rents, we tend to say that will be amortized over the residual period of the lease contract, and we adjust past periods only when there is evidence that the extra contingent rent relates to past services or to past consumption of the goods. So I think there is some inconsistency in the way we address this matter with the way we look at the revision of the estimates to contingent rents in the leasing project.
But do you accept the staff's argument that we're within the context of IAS 19 and the notion of liability in IAS 19?
I'm not convinced. I'm more sympathy for the
economic view that should recognize the expense over the periods over which you receive the benefits rather than for the relatively obscure argument that for accounting purposes, because today it is the arbitrary decision, then you have to keep like this.
I was going to make a slightly different point, but I think it's actually related in a way to Philippe's point, and maybe it will help Philippe as well. And my point's on the arbitrariness that's discussed in paragraph 19D. And I think there are probably two different circumstances. One is when it's fairly clear what we mean by the benefit formula, and it's clear what part of the amendment relates to the past. So, for example, if you have a formula that says we will give 1% for each year of service, and the amendment is to change it so it's 1.5% for each year of service, then I think it's relatively clear what part of that amendment relates to the past, because it just ties in naturally to the benefit formula. But I think there are other cases where it would be really totally arbitrary, and you could write it into the benefit formula in lots of different ways, because it would have no impact on the way the formula works on an ongoing basis. And so then the entity would have complete freedom, I think, to write the amendment how it likes. And then there's going to be some arbitrariness about how you how much of that you relate to the past. And then I think for that kind of amendment, the arguments are much more finely balanced, I think, as Philippe says, because we are talking only about unvested benefits here. And you could say recognise it immediately, or you could say recognise it over the remaining period till vesting. So I wonder whether we should actually consider distinguishing the two cases and say that when it ties in naturally to the benefit formula that's been used on an ongoing basis, then you identify the piece that relates to the past and you recognise that immediately. And when it's really arbitrary, whether you say it's past or future, my personal inclination would probably be to take it over the vesting period.
Other comments on that?
I should say as well, I think if we do distinguish the two cases, we shouldn't take a final decision on what we do today. I think we need to come back with a...
Before we vote on this or make a decision, can you elaborate a little bit more on the scenario that is less tied to the benefit formula, less of a bright line?
Yeah, I was trying to see whether I came up with a concrete example. Like,
yeah,
I was wanting to me too as well.
The bonuses.
Yeah, so let's say there's a sort of flat rate increase, and it's going to so we'll give the employee an extra 10,000 or something, and it's not going to vest for another 3 years. Then it's not really related directly to the ongoing plan formula. It's just a sort of one-off. And you could easily structure the contract, the amendment documentation to say this is all relating to those 3 years, or you could say it's relating in some way to the past 20 years, and it wouldn't make any difference to the economics which way you described it on the piece of paper.
Well, that would lead me to believe that most plan administrators and sponsors would structure it such that it would always be a forward benefit as opposed to something that related to the past.
Right, but remember that if you link it in the way that I suggested to whether it affects the ongoing benefit formula, then there's also an economic consequence of structuring it one way or the other.
And so, how is that? I'm just trying to understand.
So in my first example, where you go from 1% per year to 1.5% per year, then that is the formula that will be in place for the future, for future service as well.
Right.
And so it's fairly natural to say this piece relates to the past and this piece relates to the future.
All I'm saying is that if you write the rule the way you're suggesting, you'll never have that situation.
Maybe you will, maybe you won't. It'll be their decision how they decide they want to remunerate the workforce.
But it gives them less flexibility, I think, in terms of the way, if they'd lock themselves into that kind of a formula.
But that's the consequence of the transaction between employer and employee, isn't it?
I mean, if I had that option, I would never vote to adjust my formula. I would always do it the way you suggested.
Right, but it won't be because of the accounting. It'll be because of the economics.
Right, and I guess the question is whether or not we're knowingly here kind of disregarding the definition of a liability and kind of following an IFRS 2 approach for the sake of throwing the reporting community a bone in terms of being able to spread this stuff.
Yeah, but part of the problem is because it's the way that IAS 19 treats unvested benefits, because they would probably not really be liabilities in other standards. And one of the peculiarities of IAS 19 is that it treats vested and unvested the same, and that's part of what causes this problem. So if I gave something over with a vesting period of 3 years, if the employee left after 2 years, I don't actually have to pay it. So there is an economic consequence.
Well, you reverse or you adjust your liabilities. It's no different than in a leasing concept or an insurance concept.
Well, at the moment, IAS 19 takes the vesting conditions into account in terms of measurements the probabilities of measurement, the probabilities of the benefit vesting are taken into account when you're measuring that liability.
And I think that's one of the awkwardnesses with unvested benefits, because during the period after vesting, what the formula says about what happens during that intervening period is to some extent arbitrary anyway, because it has no direct consequence on what will actually be paid ultimately. It matters at vesting date what the formula says.
Just to be clear, in your example of the bonus, that would be recognised in future periods.
Well, that would be my that would be my preference, I think, but I think we'd need to analyse it probably.
Yeah.
One of the other slightly complicating factors is that since we put the two categories, the long-term and the other long-term and post-employment ones together, the bonus situation is going to be a lot more common. If we went back to the IS19 way of doing it and having different treatments, then it's less key. It's possibly less common.
I didn't follow that.
The situation Peter describes, where it's just like a lump sum or whatever, is probably more common type of feature of our other long-term employee benefit. In the exposure draft, we've decided it should be the same sort of accounting for post-employment benefits and other long-term employee benefits. As Manuel mentioned, we're receiving significant pushback on that proposal in the comment letters, and we'll be asking you to think about that at that point. But it may be, if you decide to go back to the IS19 way, that the examples that Peter is citing are not that common, really.
PK, okay. Want to come in?
The issue, I think, if I remember right, we discussed somewhere in March or February of 2009, and incorrectly at that time, I thought I should dissent it only based on this, because I thought if you dissent on something, you dissent the whole thing. I was not aware of the process. But I made a point there, and I repeat it for the sake of repeating myself, that if it is accounting is for shares, we do it one way, and accounting for cash based, we are doing it another way. And that, I think, inherently doesn't appeal to me. And I feel that we should be consistent with IFRS 2 on this issue for various reasons that have been mentioned. And I continue to believe, and I'm not convinced yet, that we should do anything different from what we have done recently, comparatively recently, in the two standards, that's IFRS 2. And
the problem with taking that approach and using the existing approach in IS 19, or perhaps even Peter's approach, I guess, is that you're going to end up measuring and recognizing your past service differently to what your current how your current service is being recognized. And I think that's why I prefer to just keep the underlying requirements of IS 19 intact and treat them both the same way. Sure, that gives you when you amend the plan, that gives you a past service cost if you attribute any of those benefits to prior service. But if you had attributed, if you hadn't made the plan amendments, if the benefits were already at the elevated level, those costs would have already gone through. Irrespective of what the vesting would have been. So
but you feel that you can reconcile the definition of so-called liability in both the places differently?
No, I think the definition of a liability under IS 19 treats unvested benefits as a liability.
That's what I'm saying, but in share options we don't do that. It's not a liability. What I meant is that reconciliation, you're comfortable, you can make that reconciliation.
PK, I think to take this to an even broader step, during the discussion of elements in the elements phase of conceptual framework, we identified the notion of a liability that's in 19 as being rather problematic in terms of being able to justify the existing accounting by reference to that notion. However, we have consistently said that's a broader issue, and we will proceed at this stage with that notion intact in 19, and that's the second phase of this project that the board might ultimately undertake. And I think that's what Manuel's saying, that we've consistently taken that view in the knowledge that there's inconsistency with IFRS 2 and probably a broader notion of liability.
Okay.
I think that's the issue we have before us as a board. Do we continue down that path, or do we want the staff to bring back a further analysis? Now, before we get into that, I'll put David's hat on and ask you guys, if we do bring it back, what's that going to do to our timetable?
Nothing much.
It depends how much you then start pulling away at the definition of a liability in IS 19, I guess.
Yeah.
If you're quite happy to keep it as it is, then it will exist as an anomaly within IS 19 and it shouldn't affect the timetable too badly.
Okay. There's going to be knock-on effects to curtailments and settlements as well. Should I talk about the termination benefits as well? Since we're on the subject, the board had previously decided to scope out the stay bonuses from the definition of termination benefits, and it did that under the current IS 19, where if it was if the termination benefits were provided through a plan amendment, for instance, those termination benefits would be recognised over the vesting period, which would be the same as US GAAP. However, if the board confirms the proposal in the exposure draft, that wouldn't necessarily be true, because if the amended formula attributed any benefits to past service, then those benefits would be recognised as a liability, yeah. And they wouldn't be necessarily recognised over the future service. So I just wanted to make the point that the board made a decision in the past based on the underlying IS 19. If we're changing the underlying IS 19, there's going to be a knock-on effect to the decision on termination benefits.
And so on. Yeah. Pull a piece of string and things unravel. Steve?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with the staff recommendation in question two. I understand the conflict that we've got. But I think we should talk about that when we come to look at the rest of IS 19, hopefully, and also in the measurement phase of the conceptual framework. And I actually think that IFRS 2 is the bit that's wrong and not IS 19.
Is there any other comments before I put the question?
You're putting the question for two, or are we discussing three? Because there is... The three else, again, the purpose of that is to converge with US GAAP, and again, we are diverging.
Yeah, but if we don't decide anything on two, then three doesn't matter.
I'm trying to be logical here. Do two before three, if that's all right. No other questions or comments? Okay, let me put the question in on page 11, paragraph 24, question two. The question is, does the board confirm the proposal in the ED to recognise unvested past service costs when the plan amendment occurs? All those that support? How many is that? 10. 10 out of 13. Those against, or are you sitting on the fence? Okay, three against.
It's depending on further analysis. I mean, I'm not definitively decided. I think I don't have a
depending upon what
further analysis that we would like to see. I'm not definitively decided on whether or not I could accept it. I think we have an open issue. I don't know exactly how to make up my mind.
Okay. Well, we won't see that further analysis based on that decision. So. We won't see any further analysis based on that decision. We've just decided to stay with the ED proposal.
Now you confuse me. Hasn't Peter come up with a kind of idea how to get it clearer? And didn't we all
he came
say
up with that?
That
but the board voted against.
Okay, I voted.
This isn't uncommon for Peter.
I
understand the reasons why Elka was against.
I was against the proposal because I like Peter's idea to make it specific if there is a clear past period adjustment, then it's past period, but if it's unclear, go for the future.
Yeah. Oh. Sure, so supporting what Peter had suggested, maybe an approach that we could explore and But that's okay. You happy with that?
So that means what is written in current IS 19?
Probably.
Consistent with what is with the notion of reliability in IS 19. It is what is written in the exposure draft.
No. Tatsumi's saying what is in current IS 19 in regard to past service costs.
It's recognised over the vesting period.
Yeah, so that.
But it doesn't make a distinction between different past service costs. It's just all of them are recognised over the vesting period.
So it's splitting the past service costs into two types and doing one for one and the other for the other.
Yeah.
Okay, Manuel, let's move on.
Okay. Question three, I think we should.
Yep.
We should talk about the termination benefits.
Do you want to say anything more about termination benefits?
No, I think I said it all before, so.
So are there any further comments or questions on termination benefits before we ask the question? PK?
Not to repeat myself, and I'm not going to, I promise. But the purpose of this is to converge with US GAAP. I just wanted to understand why we brought this up, and if I remember the conversation, this is convergence with US GAAP, and are we converging with US GAAP? I'm not saying we should converge, but I'm just asking, the purpose is that, and what are we doing here?
That, back when the ED was published in 2005, I think that was the objective.
Well, the objective was to converge with parts of US GAAP because it isn't all consistent.
You're not fully converging. There are areas you don't touch. Yeah, I refer to that. I know that. But in the basic recognition also, you're not going to converge with US GAAP on this issue.
No, recognition, we will converge with US GAAP on this issue.
Attribution.
We would be on the balance sheets. They recognize everything prior service costs on the balance sheet. However, they present the effect of that in OCI, and then they recycle that through income. So that's a presentation, I think. But on the balance sheet, would be the same.
Any other questions or comments? Okay, we turn to page 12, question 3, and I'll put the question to the board. Does the board confirm the proposal in the exposure draft?
The
tentative decision to include in the definition of termination benefits only benefits provided in exchange for termination of employment. All of those in favour? So that looks like 12. And you're against.
Okay.
You're moving on to 4C?
Yeah. Move on to our 4C, disaggregation. This paper has two sections again. The first is just on disaggregation in general, and the second talks about the interaction between service costs and the remeasurement components. I just wanted to note that this paper doesn't really discuss the presentation of these components. That's going to be discussed next month. What we're asking the board in this paper is whether the items have different characteristics and whether it would be relevant to disaggregate them. Most respondents agreed with both proposals. People that disagreed with the proposals in the exposure draft. Similar issues to the disagreements on recognition, such as interaction with other projects, future pensions projects. There's also that some believe that the amount shouldn't be disaggregated. They represent a single amount that relates to personnel expense. It's more that the interest element is incidental to the service. It just arises because of the service, so they prefer to view it all at once, all in aggregate. Very few respondents disagreed with excluding changes in estimates from service cost components. The ones that did disagree with that did so because they weren't sure whether the changes in estimates were a remeasurement or they were a change in estimate under IS 8 and they thought that it was a departure from the general principle of ISA if we include changes in estimates, not in P&L. But then again, that's touching on presentation. Moving on to the staff analysis, the staff agrees with the majority of the comment letters that the following components of changes in defined benefit costs have different characteristics, that the service cost arises from employees providing service and accruing additional benefits during the period, the finance cost that arises from the deferral of the payments of those benefits, and thirdly, the remeasurements of the service and those finance costs. Is there any questions before?
Questions, Tatsumi?
Yeah. I think that in 4D, you have a different proposal, I think. But the question in here, is it just to separate in three factors? That, I do not understand.
The first question is whether we want to be disaggregating the change.
But it's not necessary on the face of income statement.
No, this isn't about presentation. We'll talk about presentation in the next month. But this is just the basics of disaggregation. Do these components have different characteristics? And does it make sense to show those components separately, whether it's on the face of the statement or in the notes?
I have a trouble. I agree with 4D's proposals. And if it is reflected, say, in that way, I will support the separation in three parts. But if not, I do not support this one. So how can I vote it?
So Tatsumi, is what you're saying basically that you agree that there should be disaggregation only if it's disaggregated in a particular way?
Oh yeah, because at the moment the proposal is, I do not understand the meaning of the OCI. So.
Okay, but before you even get to OCI,
sorry?
Before we even get to OCI, we need to decide to separate bits out.
My basic position is on the face of financial income statement. One line should be provided, only one line, everything is on one line, and as a note, the factors should be provided, but not the way it is proposed under the ED, but to take into account the proposal in 4D, this one.
I think the sequence, the way we're thinking about this, Tatsumi, is just, number one, whether we should be disaggregating the change. Number two, how we define those components. Based on those, we're going to talk about presentation. Now, I guess if you disagree with the way that we define certain components, you may have different views about presentation. But at the moment, I think we're just trying to take them logically in sequence. Obviously, the decisions that the board makes in this paper, in the next paper, will impact the board's decisions on presentation as well. However, we're just trying to tackle them in sequence.
You won't be bound by this decision in terms of the next decision you want to make. This is just disaggregating
those
numbers into certain other numbers, whether they appear on the face or in the notes.
The trouble is that I agree with the sort of the disaggregation, but not this way.
Yeah, but you agree there should be disaggregation. Okay, you could vote for this, I think.
Yeah.
Put your hand halfway up. Paul?
I also, like Tatsumi, I agree with the proposal in paper 4D, but that then leads me to say disaggregation is even more important. Because of the way we're going to measure the finance component in 4D. I did not realize until you just responded to Tatsumi that the question in 4C meant disaggregation in the footnotes. I thought.
This is what the staff is saying. We're going to come to that next meeting.
Well, that's but to me, presentation is. where on the face of a financial statement, if you're suggesting that a piece could actually go in the note, put a whole one line is still a possibility.
What you'd like to do.
I know it. So that's still up for grabs. That when we're answering in 4C, we might still have one line presentation and all of the pieces shown only in a note.
Yep. You could make that decision, yes.
Okay.
I don't think the board will, but
okay. No, I didn't even realize that was contemplated in paper 4C.
Sure was. We had a long discussion on that.
I don't think we're going to go through the whole permutations of different approaches to presentation based on these decisions. I think we'll just concentrate on the proposals in the ED and we'll go from there. Yeah.
Then I support both yes to 4C and yes to 4D when we get there.
Oh, okay. PK, you're fine.
I support the staff proposals here in 4C, but I like to know that disaggregation is relevant only if you do something with information you get after you have made a disaggregation. And what you do with that is presentation to me, so it's quite difficult to say we discuss disaggregation without having in mind what we do with that presentation. I think that the argument that people make that in certain cases they view the finance cost component as an operating item rather than a financial item as sense, and we discussed in the FSP project the introduction of an operating / finance element in the operations that does. But I don't think that this we are prohibiting people from classifying this finance component as an operating item. So we will discuss it in 4D, but having that in mind, I agree with the proposal.
Okay. Does anybody disagree? Steve, you do. Not
I don't disagree. I mean, I absolutely agree. I think it's essential that these three things are identified. But I'm surprised at Tatsumi, because it seems to me that if you support the proposal in 4D, you wouldn't support disaggregation.
No.
Because the whole notion of, we'll come on to it, the whole notion of expected return is that it reduces the cost of providing pensions. And therefore, service cost minus the gain you make from the expected return, that is the cost. So it seems odd that I would have thought you wouldn't have supported disaggregation had you supported 4D.
I think that's the whole theory underlying
the Earth Gap. That's right. That's why they put it into the one line.
Right, yeah.
Absolutely.
My position is everything should be in one line on the face of financial statement, but people would like to have the disaggregated information. I don't disagree to provide that information, but the way it is provided should be the sort of the service cost. And I have a different views, but I could accept the sort of the finance and the sort of the actuarial gains and losses.
If he would disaggregate in the notes, Steve.
Yeah. So only
on one line on the face.
Yes.
Okay. Well,
that's why I think he could support this. Yes.
So this question is really
cheeky.
Yeah. Because everything is in here, so we could. It is very difficult to
feel like the stars leading you down a path.
Yeah, but you also.
Does anybody disagree with the disaggregation that is proposed and we proposed in the ED set out in question 1A on page 4? You disagree?
I just want to be crystal clear what Paul asked. I just want to be crystal clear. We are talking disaggregation irrespective of where it is presented.
Yes.
So I have a tentative vote to say that yes, I agree for disaggregation, but I don't know.
Okay. There's a few people with caveats, but
caveats,
the staff are just asking us if we agree with what we had in the ED, that you would have this disaggregation of the DBO and the plan asset. Yes? Okay, no, that's unanimous.
Yeah.
And then also... halfway up. And then question 1B, which is focusing on the service costs and the exclusion of gains and losses arising from changes in estimates and assumptions. Estimates of assumptions used to measure that service cost Does anybody disagree with that proposal? No, that's unanimous as well. So you'll take us on to 4D then? This is the exciting paper.
The exciting paper.
Decisions under their belt.
I know we've got
some runs on the board, so I think we're ready to tackle our 4D. Okay, the exposure draft proposed the net finance approach. That is, the finance costs would be calculated based on the interest using the discount rate used to measure the defined benefit obligation multiplied by the net asset or liability on the balance sheet. The basis for that decision included in the exposure draft is included in Appendix A. I'm not going to go through the discussions that led to that. Instead, I'll just talk about the views in the comment letters. I just want to point out that the views really focused on the disaggregation of income on the plan assets. So this paper focuses on that issue as well. And the two approaches considered by respondents to the exposure draft were the net interest approach in the exposure draft, but also the existing approach to calculating interest income on plan assets in IAS 19. That's the expected return approach. There was quite significant support on both sides. It was somewhat skewed. I mean, of course, preparers, pension funds, etc. They were more supportive of the expected return approach, while a majority of actuaries, the accounting professional bodies, national standards setters supported the net interest approach. And there were mixed views in the accounting firms and the other respondents with no clear majority supporting either approach. Users were a bit mixed as well. There were some users, and I'll discuss their views a bit further on. Some users supported the net interest approach. Some supported the expected return approach. However, they didn't believe the expected return was necessarily a better approach. They just didn't believe that the net interest approach was a significant enough improvement to move on. Just going through the arguments respondents expressed in support of the expected return approach. Relevance and comparability. Respondents that supported that approach believed that the underlying economics of the plan assets were better represented by the expected return. The net interest approach would present a finance cost or a notional interest that wouldn't represent the underlying economics of those plan assets. They also noted that the existing requirements in paragraph 78 on determining what discount rate to use to discount the DBO has two different targets depending on whether a deep marketing high quality corporate bonds exists, and they thought that applying this rate to the assets as well would exacerbate the existing anomaly. They also supported the expected return approach because they believed it was more consistent with the measurement of the plan assets at fair value. They view the expected return as kind of the discount rate used to measure the assets at fair value, so the expected return over the year would represent the unwinding of that discount rate. They also noted that the expected approach is more consistent with US GAAP, and the net interest approach will introduce divergence between IFRS and US GAAP. While supporters of the expected return acknowledge that it is subjective, they also noted that other areas in accounting require management judgments and are equally subjective. that subjectivity might provide an opportunity for abuse, but that shouldn't be the primary concern of the board. They did suggest, our supporters of the expected return, they did suggest some ways of limiting the range of that subjectivity or management judgment in determining the expected return. Supporters also noted the effect on behaviour. They believe that the net interest approach would discourage investment in equities and would lead to suboptimal investment decisions. As I mentioned earlier about the views of users, some respondents in general expressed a kind of qualified support for the expected return. They don't agree with the expected return approach per se, but they do not believe that the net interest approach is a significant enough improvement to justify a change at this point in time. These respondents argue that the board can still achieve its objectives of improving comparability and understandability by eliminating the existing presentation and recognition options in IS 19, and that this could be achieved without eliminating the expected return approach. Respondents that supported the net interest approach stated the following reasons. Understandability. The net interest approach is a lot more simple and a lot more easier to understand. An assets or a liability on the balance sheet will give rise to interest income or interest expense, respectively. That's not necessarily the case for an expected return approach, because a net liability might give you a finance income. Some respondents noted that supported the net interest approach because they believed it improved comparability, because it requires entities to calculate the finance costs using the same rates. Some respondents that supported the net interest approach supported because the expected return approach allows entities to report their expected performance for the year as their kind of actual performance for the year. The net interest approach is also based on expectations at the beginning of the year of what the interest rate will be for that year. However, the interest rate is independent of what the liability is, the economics of the liability, that is. Supporters noted that the discount rate for the defined benefit obligation is a more objective measure than the expected return. And finally, supporters of the net interest approach also noted the effect of behaviour, since the net interest approach presents both the benefits of taking risk and the cost of risk in the one place in the remeasurement components, contrasting that with the expected return, which presents the benefits of taking risk in the finance cost components, whereas the costs go in the remeasurement components. Some argue that this treatment creates an uneconomic incentive to invest in risk assets because you get the benefit through P&L. That's why they prefer the net interest approach. We discussed this at the employee benefits working group.
Just a minute. You mentioned one point from constituency is, you know, maybe different plans should be accounted for differently. It depends on who manages the plan itself. Can you further elaborate?
I'll talk a bit about that further on if I can. I just want to talk a bit more about the views, and when we move on to the staff analysis, I'll talk a bit about that point here. As I mentioned, we did discuss this at the Employee Benefits Working Group on the 27th of September. We presented these views, these arguments that constituents have expressed in the common letters to the working group, and we asked them to provide us with kind of an assessment, i.e. what weight we should be giving these arguments. I think overall, I think there was quite strong support for the net interest approach from the Employee Benefits Working Group. However, I just want to concentrate on what individual members where individual members put emphasis on different arguments. I think in support of the net interest approach, I think the employee benefit, the working group put more emphasis on the understandability and the reporting expected performance arguments. The view that the net defined benefit asset or liability is an amount receivable or payable to the plan, and they thought that was a very good view of the amounts in the balance sheet. So the finance cost represents the finance income or expense on that asset or liability on the balance sheet. Consistent with the views in the comment letters, the employee benefit, the working group were concerned that the expected return approach presents the return expected at the beginning of the period as the performance during the period, regardless of what the actual performance was. In terms of support of the expected return approach, I think the working group placed greater weight on the fact that the net interest approach does not represent the underlying economics of the plan assets, while the expected return approach provides more predictive value because it's more representative of those plan assets. They also put greater weight on the argument that it's more consistent with measurements. The view that the net defined benefit asset or liability is a result on the balance sheet is a result of measuring two items on different bases and then netting them off. There was less emphasis on the effect on behavior of the proposals. Working group members noted that they heard arguments on both sides about the effect on behavior, and they really de-emphasized the consideration on the effect of behavior. Instead, we should be trying to find the most objective approach that represents the changes. And also on subjectivity, working group members did note that the expected return is subjective. However, there is subjectivity in a lot of other accounting judgments made. Moving on to the staff analysis. Both supporters of the net interest approach and the expected return approach argued that their respective approaches produce more relevant, comparable, and understandable information. Now, this could be due to different views taken on what the net amount represents. It could also be due to plan design or control of the plan assets in different jurisdictions. Some jurisdictions entities have quite a large amount of control over those plan assets. In other jurisdictions, the plan is more independent of the entity, and they're more inclined to view the net amount as a receivable or payable, whereas the entities that do have quite a bit of control are more inclined to view that as part of the entity. Now, the expected return approach is, I guess, is more consistent with the gross view of that net amount on the balance sheets. If you think about it as two amounts being offset against each other on the balance sheet, derived on a different basis. However, the net interest view is more consistent with the presentation of those items on the balance sheet. We are just presenting the net amount on the balance sheet, and I think we are talking about presentation here, and perhaps that is a better way of presenting the finance cost on that net amount on the balance sheet. We agree that the expected return approach does provide more comparable information about the plan assets than the net interest approach. However, we note that the discount rates on the obligation doesn't reflect the economics of the obligation either. If you apply the net interest on the plan assets, it wouldn't reflect those economics, but it doesn't really reflect the economics of the obligation either. Some believe that the board should be applying the same approach to both sides. So on the net amount apply the a rate that doesn't reflect the economics of Elon. We also agree with the view that the net interest approach provides more understandable information about the net defined benefit asset or liability, and that's just on the basis that if you have an asset on the balance sheet, it gives rise to interest income, and if you have a liability on the balance sheet, it gives rise to interest expense. In terms of consistency with measurement, we note that the basis of presentation is arrived at using two different measurement bases on the plan assets. A different measurement basis on the plan assets and a different measurement basis on the defined benefit obligation. The plan assets are measured at fair value, and the DBO is measured using the projected unit credit method. IAS 19 doesn't determine that net amount directly. Given this, it's not possible to assess what the net interest that would have arisen if that net amount was measured directly. Therefore, we think the expected return approach is more consistent with how the net amount is measured using two different measurement bases. On reporting expected amounts in the profit and loss, I think it's important to note that all amounts under IAS 19 at the moment in profit or loss are based on assumptions at the beginning of the period. It includes service costs, finance costs. However, there are concerns that because the expected return approach is more dependent, the rate used is more dependent on the underlying assets, whereas the rate used to determine, for instance, the finance costs on the liability does not depend on the underlying economics of the DBO, that it introduces an accounting arbitrage that people could take advantage of. And by applying the interest rate used to measure the DBO to the plan assets as well, we eliminate that accounting arbitrage. On the convergence issue, we do note that the net interest method will be moving further away. However, we will not be converging with US GAAP on presentation regardless, depending on the decisions we make in the next month concerning what items go into OCI and whether those items get recycled. We agree that the expected return is subjective. However, we agree that with the views that there are other judgments in accounting that are equally subjective. We think that the degree of subjectivity involved in determining the expected return does not arise because of that approach itself. It's rather the degree of subjectivity depends on the availability of observable inputs. For instance, if your plan assets are invested in government bonds, the expected return wouldn't be as subjective as it would if the plan assets were invested in equities. The subjectivity argument was one of the reasons the board presented in the basis for conclusions in support of the net interest approach. If the board still has concerns about subjectivity, perhaps we can think about ways in which we can perhaps provide further disclosure, or the recommendation in this paper is to perhaps amend the requirements to ensure that the expected return is determined on a consistent basis with the measurement of those plan assets at fair value. At the moment, IAS 19 specifies that the expected return should be based on market expectations, so it's just providing a bit more guidance about that. As noted previously, the effect on behaviour has been noted by supporters of both approaches. We think the board should concentrate on what's the most objective approach that faithfully represents the change arising from the passage of time in defining the finance cost. In summing up, I think there's significant support for both approaches in the comment letters. However, I guess choosing one will obviously disappoint supporters of the other. looking at the arguments for and against each approach are, the expected return approach is more consistent with the measurements of the plan assets and reflects the underlying economics of those plan assets. It therefore provides more comparable information. However, it does result in the reporting of the expected performance of those plan assets during the period. The net interest approach, on the other hand, is more consistent with the presentation of the net defined benefit asset or liability on the balance sheet. It's much simpler and it's a pragmatic solution and provides more understandable information. However, the net interest approach does diverge more from US GAAP and it does not reflect the underlying economics of the plan assets. We don't believe that the advantages and disadvantages clearly favour either approach. That isn't to say that we don't believe that the net interest approach represents a significant enough improvement to justify the change at the moment. That's not an endorsement of the expected return approach. It isn't to say that the expected return is better or that the net interest approach isn't good. However, without a clear improvement, it is difficult to recommend the change, which is why the staff recommendation is to define the finance cost component based on the expected return approach. And it's important to note that we agree with the views that significant improvements can still be achieved in the project in terms of improving comparability and understandability by eliminating the options for presentation recognition. And these benefits can be achieved while still keeping the expected return approach as a basis for defining the finance cost component.
Well, thank you very much. I think you've tried to be very even-handed in your summary of the various arguments and also in the explanation of the staff recommendation. So it therefore leaves us to have a discussion about what we think and come to a view. So, Philippe, would you like to kick off?
Yeah, maybe one element of the decision-making process is this issue of convergence or divergence from US GAAP. Is there any prospect from PFASB's standpoint that it could move to something like the net interest approach, or are they clearly entrenched in the expected return approach for the foreseeable future? In a way, is there any reaction in the US that gave some support to the net interest approach and could lead the FSB to move in that direction? If not, I think the fact that we would have one party which is stable and entrenched its position and thus moving away from a converged solution to a less converged solution is clearly problematic in the current context in the world.
Maybe this is a question that's best for Peter, but to my understanding, there's no current project to look at using a net interest approach. The FASB's position, as far as I understood it, has always been that they would wait to see what we have done in this before deciding what to do next. So, of course, we can't predict that.
And we didn't receive a comment letter from the FASB. I think they're busy doing other things.
Consistence of the FASB, not the FASB, but the US consistence may have taken a view specifically on that issue which the FASB would consider as well.
I think that consistent with the views in most other places, I think the views were quite mixed from the US as well. If we talk about preparers, there were some that supported the net interest approach. and some that supported the expected return approach. I didn't see a real any real direction from US constituents, I think.
Okay.
Well, I think, first of all, it's an excellent paper with all the arguments summarized. And I would have one statement and one question. The one statement first, I think, considering all the pros and cons, I'm always firmly believing that if I'm not convinced that something is broken and put in place something that is clearly better, I wouldn't change. That's perhaps going in the direction of expected return, because I'm not seeing the clear advantage of the net interest approach. But I would be interested in something else. We have another project out that relates to pensions in a broader sense. So, Peter, what's your take if we were to stay here with expected return when you look at IFRS 4 and the new project? Any consequences or any arguments we need to take out of this?
An
open question, not a loaded one.
Yeah. As you know, there's quite a lot of discussion about the insurance contract EV and the effects on volatility, for example. And so I think different people are looking at various different ways of trying to overcome what they see as some of the disadvantages of that. I think the net interest approach doesn't really have a sort of natural counterpart, probably, in insurance, as far as I can see. I think if we retain the expected return approach here, there might be some might have some interest in trying to do something similar, I think, for insurance entities. But, of course, you couldn't really do it just looking at the liabilities in isolation. You'd need to look at the asset side at the same time if we were going to explore doing something along those lines.
Okay, thanks. That's helpful.
You done?
Yes.
Okay, thanks. Pat?
Well, the net interest approach was certainly not my first choice when we went there. But on balance, I think it's preferable to the expected return approach. That's why I supported it when we went to the ED. The staff argument is that it's not significant enough improvement over the expected return to make a change at the moment. However, I've always viewed the current IAS 19 approach that requires either immediate recognition of gains and losses or the corridor approach to dealing with gains and losses as an integral part of the expected return, that it was a package, if you will. So the board is likely to affirm elimination of the corridor approach. I think that we're tentatively going in that direction. It's likely that they'll confirm that gains and losses go to OCI without recycling. So I don't think that maintaining the expected return as defined in IAS 19 really is maintaining the status quo of the expected return in IAS 19, because I viewed immediate recognition or the corridor approach as an integral part of that use of the expected return. Also, the reason given for immediate recognition of gains and losses in this project is that the board believed that immediate recognition of gains and losses provides more useful information. And I think that using the expected return will result consistently in including future expected gains and losses on plan assets in P&L rather than recognizing what's actually happened in the current period. So while we will be eliminating one problem, that is the deferral of recognition of gains and losses that happened this period, we will be instead moving to recognizing future gains and losses in the current period. Under the net interest approach, I wasn't a big supporter of the net interest approach, but I viewed it as an allocation of the current period's actual return, that we were trying to measure or get a surrogate for the time value of money part of the current period's actual return. And so I thought that was consistent with immediate recognition of gains and losses, where I don't think the expected return is. So I just think using the expected return is counter to the objective that we set out in undertaking this project in the first place.
Thanks, Pat. Tetsumi?
Thank you. So I'd like to commend staff in making a very difficult decision and to decide to maintain the expected return approach. So I think your analysis, I highly appreciate your analysis.
Because you agree.
I'm not sure this, now by having the expected return approach, the difference between the actual return on plan asset and the expected return on asset is now, currently we call it actual gains and losses. So that notion, we keep it. So it's a good thing, because the current proposal is that actual gains and losses should be recognized when it occurred, but as part of OCI. Now OCI has a meaning. So I think it's an improvement compared with the exposure draft. But whether this expected return on asset is financing cost or not, is I'm not yet convinced. So the reasons why I prefer the one-line presentation is the this return on expected return on asset, whether it's a part of the financing cost is not, is I don't think that it's not the part of the finance cost. So having the disaggregated presentation, it seems to me we face this kind of a difficult treatment. So I don't like the on the face of the statement to have this disaggregated information. And in response to what Pat said, is pointed out the immediate recognition, everything, say current IAS 19 has a choice of the immediate recognition as net income, but under current our proposal is even management would like to recognize everything in net income. It is prohibited because we require part of the that is the OCI part should be recognized as OCI, and even management would like to recognize everything as part of net income. It is prohibited. I think I wonder it's an improvement from the current 19 or not. I have a very strong doubt about that. So if the management would like to recognize everything as part of net income, we should keep allowing the management to do so. So we try to get rid of the sort of the many options, but it seems to me, to require everybody to separate it into net income and some part as OCI and no non-recycling is, I think, it's too much. So I strongly believe that there should be an option for the management to recognize everything as part of net income. So it's not directly related to this 4C, but just in response to part, I express my views. Thank you.
That's it. Steve?
Well, I was very surprised by the level of support for the net interest approach, I have to say. I'll explain why in a second, because 80% of actuarial professional bodies supported it, 73% of actuarial firms supported it. You exclude corporates, 62% overall of all the respondents supported it, either agreement or conditional agreement. And the corporates, of course, tip it the opposite way. So when you include the corporates, it's 42% that support net interest, because the vast majority, 76% of corporates and preparer associations supported the expected return. So there was an enormous split. And I say I was surprised because, you know, the staff knows that I had a number of issues with the basis when we were drafting this. And the basis, I mean, BC 32 talks about the return being arbitrary and the whole thing being a practical expedient, and of course that was picked up on in many, many of the comment letters. And the basis starts off with a description about using the discount rate as the expected return on the assets and dealing with assets and liabilities separately, which of course isn't what the net interest approach is all about. The net interest approach is described correctly in the middle, in the paragraphs in the middle, but, of course, it's sort of damned with faint praise, in a sense, in the basis, which was my problem initially. So the fact that there was this amount of support, I thought, was amazing, given you know, where we started in the whole thing. But let me go to paragraph 33 here, which is the sort of the central crux of your recommendation, that it's consistent with the measurement of the asset or liability and reflect the underlying economics. And this was something that was included in many, many of the preparers' comment letters, that the economics is that they invest in risky assets to produce a return that therefore reduces the cost of providing pensions. And that's fine in the sense that it would hopefully reduce the expected cash outflows in respect to pensions, but I dispute that it changes the cost of providing pensions. You see, what we're likely to do is to put the actuarial gains and losses into OCI. I agree with that. I don't think it's the best way of dealing with it, because I think we need to revisit performance reporting, but I agree with that approach. And the problem if we go with the expected return is that you're putting the expected rate of return on those risky assets in profit and loss, and yet you're putting the risk associated with the risky assets in OCI. So I think completely the opposite, that it's failing to reflect the underlying economics by using the expected return. Now, if we have the actual return in the P&L, or if we have the actuarial gains and losses in the P&L, I might think of it differently. But to give people the credit for investing in risky assets in the income statement without showing the cost of investing in those risky assets, which is the risk and the volatility, in the same statement just doesn't seem right to me. So I disagree on the sort of whole notion that it reflects the economics. I think the better reflection of the economics is, you know, what you were saying about the presentation. So we're presenting this thing as a receivable or payable. It's a deficit or surplus. We have to make up something to the fund. We're going to get some sort of benefit back from the fund. So I think the better reflection of the economics is the interest accretion on the amount we owe to and from the fund. Now, I accept the point that we're measuring the assets and liabilities differently, and therefore the net amount is something of an odd measure. Well, now, presumably we think it means some things. Otherwise, why are we doing it? It is a measure of the amount owed to and amount owed from. I'm sure we can improve on that measure, but it's still a measure of that, and therefore the interest accretion is a measure of the interest that's arising on that. And just to go, so I disagree with your rationale for suggesting the expected return. Just go back to paragraph 22 as well. say it provides more comparable information because it's determined based upon the underlying value of the assets. I don't see that's a reason. I think that's just a description of it. I don't see that as a justification for it. And you mentioned, you know, if we do go to expected return, perhaps we can improve on, get rid of some of the subjectivity and diversity by emphasizing that it should be done consistently with the fair value. I just don't see how you can do that. Now, sure, an equity instrument fair value reflects a certain expected rate of return, a certain discount rate that the market is applying in valuing that equity instrument. But that's unobservable. You know, the whole equity risk premium notion and expected return, you know, it's very difficult. And simply clarifying it and saying, oh, base it upon the fair value, makes no difference. It still is going to have diversity because the whole notion of the equity risk premium is a controversial and difficult one. Some people say it's 2%, some people say it's 5%, and there is no way of proving what actually it is in practice. I understand, I guess there are two reasons why one may, the only reasons that I would validly consider in terms of not doing the net interest is one, the convergence, and two, the long-term project. I accept that it does move us away from US GAAP. It was their decision not to participate and get involved in this. I think we should do it anyway. I think it's a significant improvement to warrant moving away from what they're doing. And the other one is the interaction with a long-term project. And I agree that we're likely to make changes to measurement, that we could end up with a receivable or payable that's more representatively faithful. This is a significant change, and maybe it's something that should be done in the long-term project. But I think long-term project is going to be that very long-term, and I think this is a significant improvement that we can make in the interim. So that's why I still support making this amendment.
Thanks, Steve. Daryl, I gathered you were going to say something similar. Paul? Steve covered Daryl, I think.
I also, I think the exposure draft had the right answer, at least in principle. I was taken aback a bit when you, one of the arguments in favor of the expected return was it improves predictive ability, because of course that's what we want our numbers to help users make predictions. But actually, expected return, we're doing the smoothing. And so that's why it will improve predictive ability, as opposed to presenting the volatile numbers. So I lean toward the net interest method, but I don't know whether it's this is the time to make that change. And this, your judgment is that it's not yet, that it's not a big enough improvement and should wait for the long-term project. And I really can't judge the politics, but my leaning would be the net interest method for the reasons others have articulated. I don't think it adds to predictive ability.
Thanks. Paul Young?
With me, okay? Fine. Paul Yon, I don't know him. I'm very much in line with what Steve so elegantly expressed. I think we have a model which is in many ways attractive, and for sure I will accept to live with it, but I will not vote for it. I think we have a project which is not addressing the main problem, measurement. I think we are focusing on doing a change in presentation, take away the corridor method, simplify, be more clear and open, but we're not addressing the measurement problem. If we change now to this net interest approach, we are messing around a little bit with measurements, but we're not really addressing the question. So I would hate myself if I voted in favor of that, and then later on, a year or two from now, when we sit with the measurement problem, we changed again, and people will have to explain, oh, well, now we have a new theory, a new board members, a new chairman, nothing is like that. So for that reason, I think that minimize damage, stay where we are, even though that's not method I would have favored if we had sort of a new project and no standard, and let's invent it. So therefore, I support Stoff's elegant and very precise and excellent summary of the arguments. Excellent. PK?
I don't know how much I can add to this, having so many people so elegantly articulated their positions. The point I wanted to make is that if I look at the pensions, which I shied away for many years in my professional career, and I was fortunate that I was practicing in California, so there was no pension to worry about.
Truly.
The point I want to make is that, you know, this project is, like Philly started and others have started, about convergence. The corridor method that we have eliminated, or we have tentatively decided, is not really eliminating, it's not converging with US GAAP to start with, because US GAAP's corridor method still exists, albeit in a different fashion. On balance sheet, there is no corridor method, but on the OCI, there is corridor method even to this day under US GAAP. The point I wanted to make is that if we stay with the expected return, for all the reasons that people have articulated, is there any improvement we can do by updating those numbers every time the company presents financial statements? Does that help to minimize? Because I do appreciate that somebody with risky assets expecting 33% on their return, and in reality it's 10%, and the difference is going into OCI, which is never recycled, and that bothers me, because it's an expected actual is in the actual benefits.
No longer recycled.
So if you have a huge loss, but in effect it is, they're hiding it. So people, I don't know whether that will be accepted. But all I'm trying to say is that, is there any? Can we do a short-term improvement whilst there are very good reasons why we should go for net interest approach? But is there any benefit for updating those numbers every time the company reports it? Does that help, or is that too much? I don't think it's a lot of work, honestly. I don't believe it's a lot of work.
Well, it depends what you're asking for, PK. If you're asking that they update their assumption for expected return each month, or you're asking for them to update their whole measurements and calculations each interim period. There was a lot of comments in the comment letters, and we talked about this in recognition, and we'll talk about it in presentation as well.
I missed the first hour.
About the frequency of reporting and how often they need to do the valuations. So I think we're going to have to consider the interim reporting anyway, and perhaps we can consider that when we come to it as well. But are you suggesting that people update just the expected return assumption,
what is the biggest number that is subject to tremendous change in this whole components that we have? And maybe I'm wrong, but I feel that the expected return is one of the biggest numbers. If the portfolio of the company is such that it is not highly leveraged, highly tilted towards bonds, but towards equity securities, I would feel that is the biggest number which is subject to fluctuation. So I'm just wondering whether that would help to alleviate the concern, because I think the fundamental point is that it's definitely, if I put the OCI into the whatever is in the OCI into net income, then this problem is really not there. It goes away. The problem arises because we are sticking it into OCI, and to borrow the phrase from Tatsumi, we are never recycling it. And that's the fundamental, at least I see that's the genesis of the problem.
Would that problem go away with the net interest approach, or?
It doesn't, but I think for the, as Steve articulated, at least it will do the
gains and losses, yeah, in the one place.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I guess we can consider, you know, the expected return and how often people revisit that assumption for interim reporting purposes. So that could be done. I mean, we're going to be looking at
I was just going to observe that in the North American environment, they're required to revisit it annually, and generally speaking, many companies haven't changed it in 20 years. So I don't know that a quarterly requirement to look at it is going to improve the situation.
Amara?
No, I just wanted to say that, you know, on balance, I'm stuck. I'm stuck between, like, the staff unable to really say that this is the right thing to do. And so, I don't know. I think I'll stick with expected return, but I don't like it. I don't like it.
Amara?
Thanks, Warren. Sharing with others, I think that the paper was well balanced, trying to reflect the responses and the discussions in the paper. I don't have many additional reasons to add, consider the former comments. I do prefer the net approach. I think this better reflects the economics, in my view, under the point of view of the corporate that have a relationship with the plan. So, and although doubting, as Jan and Paul, about the timing, but considering the potential to convergence with U.S. GAAP at this point, and do not foresee in the future, at least personally, the potential to change my point of view on the economics of reflecting economics of the relationship of the corporate with the plan, I would prefer the net at this point.
Okay. White work?
I want to make 3 points. First, I fully agree with Tatsumi, we should maintain options to present one number. As I say, it's related to the especially manufacturing industries. And I see this is not the management like to. It's because to present this way, it will be better reflect their economics. This is my first point. My second point is I always think pension is so closely related a country's specific environment, the way business are doing, and the tax regulations and pension regulations and others. So I pay great attention to paragraph 20. The people mentioned, you know, maybe the different plans should be measured differently, and especially as you mentioned, you know, if a company manager is pension plan by itself, it will definitely they have the information related to the return of assets, and by contrary, if it's outside of the company, and I would think maybe net interest approach will be much better. And I remember, you know, not long ago, we published an ED on discount rates, but we failed. One of the reasons why we failed is because people said, you know, you cannot use one benchmark to different jurisdictions, because different jurisdictions, the regulatory framework will be quite different. So I'm not sure whether there is a possibility to explore further based on paragraph 20. And finally, if we not willing to explore based on Trinity, I will fully support Steve.
Philippe?
Should I just reply to that?
You're very welcome to.
I think paragraph 20 and the whole discussion about presenting the plan assets and the DBO as a net amount on the balance sheet, I think that really goes to the really fundamental question of whether the entity should be consolidating its plan or whether the plan is separate and it should be recognizing a receivable or payable to it. That question is really outside the scope of this current project, and I think we would have to consider that in a future project. I don't think we'd be able to consider that in this project here.
It's interesting to contemplate, though, if you did consolidate, you wouldn't be including expected return.
Well, we wouldn't have any of these issues. I think a lot of these issues arise because of the unique accounting treatments under IAS 19. So.
That's true.
Yeah. I also wanted to follow up on one thing you said, Rebu, which was about the discount rate ED, and maybe it's just a small point, but the reason that ED didn't proceed to a final standard wasn't to do with not having one benchmark throughout the world. It was to do with the fact that within the context of our limited activities in pensions, it wasn't appropriate to make such a big change to the measurement for some countries which hadn't been, you know, considered as part of the changes that we were making.
And it is an issue that I think if the board takes the second phase on, given we will have completed our consolidation standard, then I would think it's an issue that needs to be addressed by the board in developing that second phase. So, Philippe?
Well, I liked our ID because it was, for me, a comprehensive and well-balanced package, which included the net interest approach, elimination of corridor, using OCI to record the differences between the actual return on assets and the net interest approach, and non-recycling. And now we are breaking one element of this proposal, which is to change the net interest over the expected return, but we keep all the rest. And that puts, in my opinion, a lot of pressure on the decision that we have made to not recycle the actual losses or gains which happen on realization of the assets. Because then we are breaking the harmony, we are breaking the balance. So I would prefer that we stay with our initial proposal. Or that, as has been proposed by some, that we maintain an option to recall all the actual movements in the P&L. If we are to accept the proposal of the staff, which I can live with reluctantly, that is for the sake of keeping convergence with the US and also of not making a change, as Jan said, when we are not changed, that it is forever. However, my acceptance of the staff proposal is pretty much subject to strengthening the requirements on the measurement of the expected return, which is the second part of question one. For me, the two are linked. What we were really trying to fix at the beginning of this project, apart from the elimination of deferrals on the liabilities, was also to reduce the possibility of abuse on the expected return measurement. In a way, here we are maintaining this possibility to get all the benefits, as Steve said, of investing in risky assets and not having the risk that goes together being recognized in the same category. So we must really reduce that incentive by having a measurement of the expected return which is absolutely transparent and is presented together with the difference between actual and expected return in the notes. And we must synthesize information so that it is transparent to the users. And we must try to get the expected return as close as possible to something which is reasonable. And not have an incentive to kind of increase artificially the expected return and then have the benefit of having all the difference being put in OCI and never recycled, which is my problem. So I can live with it, but subject to an improvement and strengthening of the measurement of expected return and transparency.
As I've listened to the discussion, I have to say that I haven't felt I've heard anything that's
totally persuasive one way or the other. I came into the discussion thinking that I would vote for the staff's recommendation. The reason is, when I look at the information in the financial statements with respect to a pension plan, there's a couple of questions I ask myself. First, what's the funded status, the current and the likely? Because that tells me then whether or not the sponsor, the employer, has cash contributions on the horizon. If it's well funded, it's essentially something that takes care of itself. If it's not, it has cash implications. And then I'm also interested in what's the earnings implications. To what extent are there earnings flowing through, you know, this company's financial statements that effectively like undistributed earnings from an equity investee, or to the extent they're creating losses and reconciling earnings with cash. Those are some of the basic questions I'm trying to answer. Now, the staff's recommendation, I don't think moved the ball very far in giving me greater insight or signals around those issues. If I have a single statement of comprehensive income where I can see every year the expected return and then how well or poorly management did in their expectations down here in OCI, an adjustment effectively to actual results, it's all on one page, I can actually, I think, see that as an improvement. I don't really see a whole lot of difference between the staff proposal and the net interest approach in arriving at that conclusion. In my mind, it's a little bit of geography as to where some of these gains and losses are. Are they up in P&L or are they down in OCI? So, frankly, I could flip a coin here. I am persuaded by some of the arguments that Steve has made, and you know, in that regard, I guess I would vote for the net interest approach.
Okay, well, I must say I was surprised by the staff recommendation, but I understand how you got there, and I think you explained it very well. David's view, by the way, is that he continues to support the net interest approach, but he's not going to be here to put his hand up, and I'm not going to put two hands up. My preference actually is same as Tatsumi's, probably Philippe's, that I'm not sure it is your preference, Philippe, but one possibility, okay.
Can I ask a question on that?
Yeah, sure. Go ahead.
I wanted to understand Tatsumi and Philippe's proposal. Did that mean the recognition of actual results through a recycling mechanism, or just recognize all the actual results in P&L immediately?
Tatsumi's is immediate.
So no deferral into OCI.
Yeah,
no. Well, I would vote for that. In
it's not on
but just a minute. Let's not get off track
here. Okay, all right.
Billy, you just respond to what Pat had to say.
Which is to say, park in OCI the measurements and take the realization into P&L, which is my view of recycling. But I will not win that one. I know it. I know it.
Agreed.
For the time being, at least in the current situation of the board, it may be in the future. So I would rather go then on that assumption. I would go to Tatsumi's view, which is take all the actual movements in P&L right now as an option if you don't want to have the other system.
I think it's a good idea.
Well, what about the
not
leg of the
I think it's a completely pointless idea because we've got that at the moment. And is it sort of one company in the world that takes this option? You know, I mean, what's the point of putting it in there? It won't make any, won't have any effect.
That's not.
Well, I mean, it could be an option, but why put an option in there that you know nobody's going to take?
I think we've got past that, to be quite honest. But Tatsumi, you and I are standing between us and lunch. So, what do you want to say?
Say whether nobody's used that option or not is not the issue. I think the current IAS 19 is there is a choice, and I think to get rid of the choice is it seems to me the different direction. I still strongly believe that everything related to the pension should be recognized as part of net income. So that is my support. So, and from that point of view, to get rid of the that option in currently existed in 19 is not improvement.
Thank you, Tetsu. Let me finish. The point I was going to make is that's my preference as well, but I think as Steve and others have pointed out, we're beyond that. So we're going to have an allocation mechanism, and I know you dreamt this up when I was lying in some hospital somewhere in the world, and at the time I thought, what in the heavens is this? But it's grown on me, Steve, as time's passed. I think it's a better methodology, to be honest, for the reasons that Pat and Steve have given. I just don't accept the argument that expected return better depicts the underlying economics of the plan assets at all. And also, as Philippe said, we came into this trying to do a number of things, and I recall that one of them was concern about expected return, and I heard what Pat said about how, yes, you can write all sorts of rules into these requirements and companies will probably still end up justifying their rather ambitious estimates, or heroic estimates is probably a better word. So I personally think that if we're going to have an allocation method, then I think this is probably the best way to proceed. So that's my view. I'll now put the question to you, and we should go to your question on page 12 and put the staff proposal first, that the finance cost component should be defined on the basis of expected return. Are you already voting for this, eh?
Yes.
Okay. All of those in favour of the staff recommendation? Staff recommendation.
Two.
So one, you're in favour of the staff recommendation. According to what you said, yes, which is expected return? So one, two, three, four. Those that are against the staff recommendation?
Nine.
So that's failed. So then let me put the approach that is within the exposure draft, which was the net interest approach. Those in favour of the net interest approach?
Confirming
the ED proposal. So you're now going to vote for that?
Can you vote why? Is there a third method that you're going to bring up? Like, for example, immediate...
Well, I'm going to... with the first one failed, so I'll then put what was in the exposure draft. So if that fails, then we can look at something else. So can I put what was in the exposure draft, which was the net interest approach, the basis for making the allocation? All of those in favour of the net interest approach?
Nine carried.
What was that?
Nine.
So that passes. So, ladies and gentlemen, we can now break for lunch. Thank you very much, staff. I think you did a very
Thank
good
you.
Job of that analysis and presentation. And can we come back at 2 o'clock, please?
Discuss impairment?
Yeah. 2 o'clock.
Yeah. Okay.